We are at a very interesting part of the book of Daniel. In this chapter, we have one of the most amazing prophecies ever given. It's been building up to it in chapter 10 as kind of the prelude to it. Now we're actually in the prophecy itself. And it was given hundreds of years before these events ever occurred. And it's interesting because it's one of those prophecies that's been fulfilled, at least the portion we're going to be looking at today. It happened, and it happened in amazing, shocking detail. So much so that some scholars claim they must have been written after the fact. I mean, it's just way too detailed for it to have ever been prophesied beforehand. As I pointed out before, the problem is we found books that pushed copies of Daniel that go all the way up to 100 B.C., and for them to have been accumulated and gathered up and studied the way they were, they had been around for a while before that. And so it seemed to be pushing way back into the time before those events ever occurred. See, God's not limited by time. And he knows fully what is going to take place. And so let's look today at the first or big part of this prophecy today. I'm actually going to try to cover quite a bit of it. Given in 539 B.C., because if you believe Daniel wrote it, and the Lord said Daniel wrote it, it takes you back to 539 B.C., 400 years before these things happened. And yet they did, just as he said. So remember, the prophecy is given in 539 B.C. And it starts to be fulfilled almost immediately. In 529 to 486 B.C., we have the kings of Persia that are mentioned in Daniel chapter 11. Start verse 2. And now will I show thee the truth. I like that. Here's the truth. This is what's going to happen. Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all. And by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece. Well, we know that three more kings shall rise in Persia, he says, before this one rises up who really causes the Greeks to really become upset with the Persians. Cambyses, in 529 to 522 B.C., then you had a pseudo-Smerdes, and we call him pseudo, that means a false Smerdes, because he wasn't actually him, he was an imposter the whole time, he was only in power a couple years. And then you had Darius, Hystaspes, who from 521 to 486 ruled, and then you finally come to the fourth one, which was Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, okay, who reigned from 486 to 465 B.C., and he accumulated great wealth. In fact, he accumulated all the wealth of those before him, but then he went on a four-year campaign to raise up more wealth that he might go against the Greeks. And it says here, this is one that's going to become a problem to the Greeks. He's going to create this great rift with them. And so he financed this war on Greece, the largest military that had ever been raised up, ever in the history of the time. A huge army. And yet he lost everything. He never fully recovered at the Battle of Salamis. But it's interesting, the Greek writers wrote this. He was not defeated by the Greeks, they said. He came up, he had such a large army. There was everything that said he should have won. And they argue that he was defeated by some spirit. It must have been the gods were against him. And the Lord said that he's going to bring him down because he's going to raise up the Greeks. But they did burn the Acropolis at Athens, which to the Greeks was a horrific event. It's that which Alexander the Great, the Greek emperor is coming next, that's what motivated him to want to go against the Persians, to avenge that, to pay them back for what they did to them. And so right away it says this fourth king is the one who's going to create this conflict with the Greeks, that even though there's some Persian kings that come after him, he's the one that caused Alexander the Great to want to go against the Persians when he comes to power. Well, that is the next king, verses 3 through 4. And a mighty king shall stand up that shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided into the four winds of the heaven, and not to his posterity, nor according to his dominion which he ruled. For his kingdom shall be plucked up even for others besides those. Well, here we have this mighty king that comes to power after the Persian kings, which is Alexander the Great, from 336 to 323 BC. And he has a great dominion. No one could stand against him. He's one who was never defeated. Everywhere he went, he defeated them until he was struck down at the very end. But his kingdom shall be broke into four parts, it says. Macedon and Greece went to Cassander. What happened is when he died, it didn't go to his posterity. I'm going to look at that in a minute. But it was divided up among four of his generals. Cassander took Macedon and Greece. Lysimachus took Thrace and Asia Minor. Seleucus got Syria and Babylon. And Ptolemy took Judah and Egypt. Divided among the four of them. Not given to his posterity. He had children. He had a half-brother, Philip, who was mentally deficient. And somebody killed him off in 317. But then he had a son, Alexander, who was born to him posthumously after he died through Roxana, and he was killed in 310 BC. And then he had an illegitimate son by the name of, interestingly, Hercules, by Barsine, but he's killed in 309 BC. So all of his children are killed off before this is finally divided up, so there's none of his posterity left. They're all wiped out. And that's why it goes to these four generals. And two of them become particularly important in the rest of the prophecy. The king in the south over Egypt, Ptolemy, and the king up in the north eventually, Seleucus, in Syria. And so the rest of this is really a conflict between Syria in the north and Egypt in the south. Kind of keep that in mind. And that's why he narrows it down to two kings. The king of the south, Egypt, shall be strong, and one of his princes, and he shall be strong above him and have dominion, and his dominion shall be a great dominion. The south was Ptolemy, the first Soter from 323. I don't know. Are you worried about the dates? No, you won't remember him anyway. Well, anyway, he's next. And he survived. He was one of the generals of Alexander who survived through all the turmoil and kept a firm hold on his land. He was a strong king down Egypt. In fact, he declared himself the king of Egypt in 304 BC. I'll give you that date for those who want dates. Okay? He became the king. Well, he had a prince that was under him, it mentions. Seleucus, who was given up north of Babylon in that area, Syria, he couldn't keep control of it. One of the other generals kind of pushed him out. So he came down to Egypt, and he came underneath Ptolemy, became one of his generals. And he decided to help him go back to take hold of this land that he'd lost, that which was seized by Antigonus. So they went up together, and they defeated Antigonus in 312 BC in the Battle of Gaza. And Seleucus, therefore, was returned to his land, and he declared himself king of Syria in the same year as Ptolemy declared himself king in Egypt. And now we have in the same year Seleucus declaring himself king over Syria in the north, and we have a king in the south. And he wasn't very appreciative of all that Ptolemy had done for him. In fact, he's determined to get control of the area because right in between these two kingdoms, the one in the north and the one in the south, is the land of Canaan. Israel, or actually Judea. Right in between these two, right there. And they keep going back and forth for control of this land because they both want that land. And that's why this is a prophecy given, Lord, of concern, not for these kings. You have to understand, it's concern about what's happening in the land of Israel and the conflict that's taking place. Well, they form an alliance in chapter 11, verse 6. At first, they're at peace with each other. And in the end of years, they shall join themselves together for the king's daughter of the south, Egypt, shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. In other words, you know, that's the way they made agreements back then. If a king wanted to make sure you were at peace, he would give you his daughter, and you would marry his daughter, and therefore you had kind of a family connection then. Or if you didn't got upset with you, they'd kill off your daughter, and you didn't really want that to happen, so it was keep you in line. But she shall not retain the power of the arm, neither shall she he stand, nor his arm. But she shall be given up, and that they brought her, and he that begat her, and he that strengthened her in these times. Well, Ptolemy II, Philadelphius, the next heir down the land of Egypt, they're all Ptolemies down the south. He forms this alliance between him and the Seleucus up in the north. And he gives his daughter, the daughter of Ptolemy II, by the name of Bernice. And she marries Antiochus II, Theos. And that's to seal this treaty between the two of them. By the way, it's during this time down the south in Egypt that the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible, was written. So there was a real peace between the Egyptians' kingdom and the Jews down the south. Well, she goes up north, Bernice does, but it says she shall not retain her power. What happened is this powerful king in the south, Ptolemy II, forced the marriage. He said, if we're going to make this alliance, you've got to take my daughter. There was a problem, though. Seleucus II was already married. So he had to get rid of his current wife so that he could marry Bernice and make the treaty. Well, shortly after this treaty was made, 2 years later, Ptolemy II dies. And Antiochus II, up north, the ruler of the Seleucus, or the in Syria, he decides, well, I don't want to keep Bernice. I like my old wife better. And he divorces Bernice to take his old wife back, Laodicea. I wonder if that's where they got the name of the city. But anyway, that's her. And so he takes his old wife back, who he was compelled to divorce for the alliance. Now, how do you think Laodicea feels about all this that took place? Nothing's worse than a woman scorned. She decides that her husband is a little bit fickle. You know? One minute he likes her, the next minute he doesn't. Now he wants her back. She decides there's not much security in this relationship, so she poisons Antiochus and does away with him. Now that he's out of the way, who do you think else she wants to take care of? She kills off Bernice. Okay? And Bernice's attendants, and the child that she had that could be a threat to the throne. And she proclaimed her son, whom she named Seleucus again, the second, Callisthenes, king. And she raised him up as king. Isn't it amazing how detailed this is? It's phenomenal. Well, then we go to verse 7. But out of the branch of her roots, Bernice's roots, shall one stand up in his estate, which shall come with an army and shall enter into the fortress of the king of the north and shall deal against him, them, and shall prevail. Her brother, Bernice's brother, didn't like the way they treated his sister, Bernice. So he rallies the army of Egypt and they go up into Syria to fight against this new king up there, and to teach him a lesson for what they've done to his sister. And he prevails. They defeat the Syrians, and he kills off Laodicea. She gets what she has coming to her. And he returned to Egypt with great spoils. And for a period of time, there is peace in the land. And shall also carry captives into Egypt, their gods with the princes and the precious vessels. That's what he did. He came north, defeated them, and plundered them, and brought all down to Egypt. Vessels of silver and gold, and he shall continue more years than the king of the north. He's in power for a period of time. Well, in verse 9, So the king of the south shall come into his kingdom and return into his own land. Like I mentioned, there's a time of peace that prevails. This also could be translated the other way. There's some debate about that verse, because Lucas did seek to regain, and he comes down to land, and he fails, and he has to go back north. And maybe alluding to that, we're not sure which way that should be read. In verse 10, but his sons shall be stirred up. In other words, after a while, the sons are stirred up, and shall assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overflow and pass through, and then shall he return, and he shall be stirred up even to his force. What happens is Seleucus II has two sons, and they gather up a great army. But one of the sons goes up into the north. Let's see. Verse 10. Well, Seleucus III led a great army into Asia Minor. He was one of the sons. And he died 3 years into the battle. That's one of the two sons. That's why it goes to just the one son, who went south into the land of Egypt. Antiochus III, and also called Antiochus the Great. And he led a great army into the south against Egypt. Once again, just like this verse is saying, there were two sons, assembled great armies, but one of them will certainly come down into the land of Egypt and shall prevail against it. Verse 11. By the way, he recaptures the land from Ptolemy IV, Philopter. He actually gains back the land that he lost earlier. Well, the king of Egypt now is provoked. You see how they're going back and forth? Now this general came down, this son came down from the land of Syria, and is successful and gains back part of the land. Well, now it's Ptolemy's turn in Egypt to fight back. And the king of the south shall be moved with choler, great anger, and shall come forth and fight with him, even with the king of the north. And he shall set forth a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into his hand. There's two major armies that go to battle in this verse. And the king of the south shall be moved with God. Oh, it's verse 12. And when he hath taken away the multitude, his heart shall be lifted up, and he shall cast down many 10,000s, but he shall not be strengthened by it. There's these two huge armies. The army of Egypt, give you an idea how big these armies were. They said there were 70,000 infantrymen, 5,000 cavalry, and 73 elephants. That's like tanks, okay? Syria had 62,000 infantry, 6,000 cavalry, and 102 elephants. Now, can you imagine these huge armies going over the land of Israel, fighting against each other? Ptolemy defeats Antiochus of Syria at Raphia. A great victory for him. But he's kind of an incompetent leader. And in his arrogance, he does not take advantage of it to say, okay, I defeat him, now I'm going to go up and totally conquer him and put an end to this fighting back and forth. Instead, he wins the victory, wants to go back and party. And they go back and they celebrate. And he never consolidates his victory. He never secures it by setting up fortresses. He just parties. And he ended up weaker than he was before, because the king of Syria, who lost, went up north and says, I am going to remember this. I'm going to build up my army. And so he builds it up. Verse 13, and the king of the north shall return and party and won't build it up. But verse 14, and in those times there shall be many stand up against the king of the south. Also the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish a vision, but they shall fail. There's turmoil in the south. But the north takes his time to build up his military. And what happens is eventually the king of the south dies. And the next heir is 4 years old when he comes into power. Well, but Ptolemy V, Epiphanes, is enthroned. But you know, he's not really ruling at 4 years old. It's all of his advisors. but his advisors don't get along, and there's conflict in the land. At this time, they realize it's an opportune time now for the Seleucids in the north to come back down and attack the Egyptians, the Ptolemies. And so Antiochus gains and pulls together all kinds of allies to join him. Even some Jews join with him to fight against the Ptolemies in the north. But he said, they shall not gain. That's the ruthless man he's talking about. These people of Israel who side with the northern kingdom will not gain. It's not going to go well for them. They're not going to be remembered. Here's the picture. These people join with them thinking eventually the prophecy says that the northern kingdom will prevail. Okay? So they decide to side with the north in the hopes that somehow it will create this advantage for them. But if you look at the prophecy closely, this northern kingdom will turn on the Jews eventually. It will not prevail them. It will not work out good for them, siding with this kingdom. It's kind of a warning in the midst of the prophecy. Don't think this is going to help you out any. Well, let's see, where are we at? 15. So the king of the north shall come and cast up a mount and take the most fenced cities, and the arms of the south shall be not withstand, neither his chosen people, neither shall there be any strength to withstand. Scopas, who's the leader of the southern army, has to flee to Sidon. And the force of the south come up, try to help him, to rescue him, and they make three attempts to rescue him at Scopas, rescue Scopas from Sidon, but they fail. They can't succeed. And the city was captured by building up siege works to Sidon, just as the prophecy says. And they conquer the city. And then it says, he shall stand in this glorious land. But he that cometh against him shall do according to his own will, and none shall stand before him, and he shall stand in the glorious land, the land of Israel, which by his hand he shall be consumed. He absolutely takes control of the land. Following the Battle of Panias in 198 BC, he controls it. And he brings terms of agreement, a treaty. He shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting her, but shall not stand on his side, neither before him. What he's talking about, he's making a treaty not with Israel. He's making a treaty with Egypt. He's conquered the land of Israel, and now he says he's going to enter into negotiations with Egypt to bring peace. And to secure this, Antiochus gives his daughter, you may have heard of her, Cleopatra. He gives his daughter Cleopatra, who was to marry Ptolemy, who at that time was a little bit older than four. He was now 10 years old. In other words, it's just a political treaty. The marriage was not to be finalized for 6 years when he turned 16, because they at least make him wait till he got old enough to make it right. You know, so he's at least 16. Well, anyway, she's given to them to make this treaty, just like they did earlier with Bernice, but now it's reversed now. Now they're given Cleopatra to the king of Egypt. And he wanted to be his political tool. It comes around and says his whole goal was to use her influence in the land of Egypt to manipulate things, because, I mean, her husband's 10. She's older. She should be able to control him. And really, she will become, by default, the real leader of Egypt. That was his plan. The problem is, they say she fell in love with him when he got a little older. And her loyalty shifted to Egypt. And perhaps she rejected what her father had done to her. But she doesn't side with the Syrian kingdom. She sides with Egypt. And she's loyal to them. And so it failed. She chose her husband and her husband's land over her father. Well, he turns his efforts now to the coastland. After this, Antiochus shall turn his face unto the isles and shall take many. In other words, the islands, the lands. He's succeeding along the coast and taking the islands. But a prince for his own behalf shall cause a reproach offered by him to cease. Without his own reproach, he shall cause it to turn upon him. Well, what happens, he went up and he conquered and attacked Asia Minor, and then he went on to attack Greece. But Rome had enough of this, and they intervened. And that's why he talks about islands. When it refers to Shittim here a little bit, that's really the island of Cyprus. And so he comes from there, and he intervenes and defeated him at Thermopylae, and later at Magnesia, and Antiochus had to abandon his conquest. He's defeated in 188 BC. So he returns back to the fortresses, and there he falls. 1 year after the treaty with Rome, Antiochus is killed while seeking to rob the temple in Bel Elam. Then he shall turn his face toward the forts of his own land. He go back home, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. He's found doing this, and they bring an end to him. He's done. Then shall stand up in his estate a raiser of taxes. The next ruler isn't really one of much political power, except now that they've lost to Rome, they have to pay this huge tribute. So they start raising taxes in the glory of the kingdom. But within days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle. What happened is Seleucus IV, Philopater, became the one in power after Antiochus dies. And he sent his servant Heliodorus, his finance minister, to Jerusalem to gather up taxes for these bills they had to pay to Rome. But it was prevented in a vision, they say, and he didn't take the money from the temple. But he plots against the new leader, against Lucas, and has him assassinated. And so that's the end of that period of time. Well, out of this turmoil, as you can see, there's this desire for somebody to bring some stability to the land, somebody to rise to power. And then we have what's called a vile man, a despicable king, who rises to power. And this is Antiochus Epiphanes, the next ruler. They love the name Antiochus in the north, just like they did love Ptolemy in the south. And this is verse 21. And in his estate shall stand up a vile person, a vile, despicable person, to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceable and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. This Antiochus Epiphanes means glorious one. And it's interesting how scripture says he's not glorious, he's vile, despicable, a scoundrel. That's what God thought of him. And he sees the throne through intrigue. He didn't get it honorably. When his predecessor, Seleucus IV, was died, there was two viable candidates for the throne because he had two relatives. There was Demetrius I, Sauter, who was his oldest son, who retained but as a hostage in Rome. And so he never had a chance to come back to land. And so Heliodorus says, well, I'm going to work on his behalf. And then there was an infant son, a young Antiochus, whom Antiochus IV claimed allegiance to. And he says, I'm working on his behalf to help him get into power. And so these two people rose up. Neither one of them have any rightful claim to the throne, but always claiming to be working for somebody else. And they go and fight against each other. And the one defending the infant, Antiochus, through his political savvy, won the support of the people. And he claimed his allegiance through flattery that he was just doing this for this poor heir because Demetrius was somewhat discredited as a hostage in Rome. And so he gains a following. And he secures the throne for himself. Because right after he gains the power and he finally wins on behalf of this infant son, what do you think he does with the infant son? He has him killed. And so he's now in power. Verse 23. And after the league was made with him, he will work deceitfully, as I just mentioned, for he shall come up and shall become strong with a small people. He just keeps gaining more and more power through his connections. He shall peaceably even upon the fattest places of the province, and he shall do that which his fathers have not done, nor his fathers' fathers. He shall scatter among them the prey and the spoils and the riches. Yea, he shall forecast his devices against the strongholds even for a time. So using bribes and resources, he wins over. Starts out small, but he gains this following. He swept over all those who opposed him. He destroys the army of Celadoris. He destroys the forces of Egypt. He uses his wealth to gain a following. And it says here, he swept over the prince of the covenant. That's the high priest. He disposed of and murdered the high priest, Ananias. And then he sold his position to Ananias' brother, because Jason paid him more. So he removed Ananias and he put Jason, who was more devoted to Hellenism, to spreading the Greek culture. But then Menelaus paid him more, and so he removed Jason and he put Menelaus. So anyone who was willing to pay money could become the high priest. You just had to be willing to pay more. And so he kept getting bought off. Well, Antiochus grows in power, verses 25 through 26. He just increases. He shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with great army, and the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a great arm, a mighty army, but he shall not stand, for they shall forecast devices against him. His advisors poorly advise the 16-year-old king of Egypt to stir it up to action, and he loses. And finally, the northern kingdom becomes the powerful kingdom. Well, in verses 27 through 28, and both these kings' hearts shall do mischief, and they shall speak lies at one table. In other words, you see these two guys down at the table, you're not going to get an honest word from either one of them. That's politics for you. But it shall not prosper, for yet the end shall be at the time appointed. So they come together, and they're all lying as they make this treaty together, and they don't mean a word of it. Then shall he return to his own land with great riches, and his heart shall be against the holy covenant, and he shall do exploits and return to his own land. What happened is, because he was forced to make this treaty, and by the way, it was Cleopatra who forced these two guys to sit down. She finally says, okay, brother, come here. Husband, sit down. Can you imagine this? Yeah. And she tells him, you guys are going to make a treaty. Okay. And so she gets her way. The fighting is put in stop. But how do you think Antiochus, her brother, felt when he had it back? He was mad. And guess who he took it out on? The Jews. He shall return with riches and with arrogance and take revenge on the people of the covenant, the Jews, because at one time they sided with Egypt. And he will defy the covenant he had made with Judah. He slaughtered the Jews in Jerusalem, and he carried off all the wealth of the temple. I'm going to read this. Bear with me. Inserting all the names. I found a copy of this. It was put together by Pierce. And it's a great work. He just put in all the names. And so you can follow along in your chapter, but I'm going to be putting the names in where this happens. And you'll see how detailed this prophecy has been fulfilled. Now then, I tell you the truth. After Cyrus the Great, three more kings will rise in Persia. Cambyses the Second, Gamata, which was Pseudo-Smerdis, and Darius the First. Then the fourth shall rise, Xerxes the First, who will be far richer than all the others. When he has gained power by his wealth, he will stir up everyone against the kingdom of Greece. Then a mighty king will arise, Alexander the Great, who shall rule with great power and do as he pleases. After he has arisen, his empire will be uprooted and given to his four generals, Cassander, Lysimachus, Seleucus, and Ptolemy. Ptolemy the First of Egypt will become strong, but one of his commanders, Seleucus the First, will become even stronger than he and will rule over his kingdom, own kingdom of Syria with great power. After some years, they will become allies. Bernice, the daughter of Ptolemy II, will go to Antiochus II of Syria to make an alliance, but she will not retain her power, and he and his power will not last. In those days, she shall be betrayed, together with her royal escort and her father Ptolemy Antiochus, who supported her. Bernice's brother, Ptolemy III, will rise to take her place. He will attack Seleucus II and enter his fortress. He will fight against them and be victorious. He will also seize their gods, their metal images, and their valuable articles of silver and gold and carry them off to Egypt. You see, as you follow through the chapter, it's exactly what the chapter is saying. For some years, he will leave Seleucus alone. Then Seleucus will invade Ptolemy's realm, but will retreat to his own country. His sons, Seleucus III and Antiochus III, will prepare for war and assemble a great army, which will sweep on like an irresistible flood and carry the battle as far as the fortress of Ptolemy IV. Then Ptolemy will march out in a rage and fight against Antiochus, who will raise a large army, but it will be defeated in the Battle of Raphia. When the army is carried off, Ptolemy will be filled with pride and will slaughter many thousands. Yet he will not remain triumphant, for Antiochus will muster another army larger than the first, and after several years, he will advance with a huge army fully equipped. In those times, many will rise against Ptolemy V. Those who are violent among the Judeans will rebel in fulfillment of the vision, but without success. Then Antiochus will come and build up siege ramps and will capture the fortified city of Gaza. Ptolemy's forces will be powerless to resist. Even his best troops will not have the strength to stand against him in the battles of Panias and Sidon. Antiochus will do as he pleases. No one will be able to stand against him. He will establish himself in Judea and will have the power to destroy it. He will determine to come with the might of his entire kingdom and will make an alliance with Ptolemy, and Antiochus will give Ptolemy his daughter Cleopatra in marriage in order to overthrow the kingdom. But his plans will not succeed or help him. Then Antiochus will turn his attention to the coastlands of the Mediterranean and will take many of them, including Thrace. But the Roman commander Cornelius Scipio will put an end to his insolence and will turn his insolence back on him in the battles of Thermopylae and Magnesia. After this, he will turn back towards the fortress of his own country, Syria, but will stumble and fall to be seen no more. His successor, Seleucus IV, will send out his tax collector, Heliodorus, to Jerusalem to maintain the royal splendor. In a few years, however, Seleucus will be destroyed, yet not in anger or in battle. Seleucus will be succeeded by Antiochus Epiphanes, a contemptible person who had not been given the honor of royalty. He will invade Seleucus' kingdom when its people feel secure, and he will seize it through intrigue. Then an overwhelming army will be swept away before him, both it and the prince of the covenant. Ptolemy VI will be destroyed. After coming to an agreement with him, Antiochus will act deceitfully, and only a few people will rise to power. When the riches of the province feel secure, he will invade them, but only for a time. With a large army, Antiochus will stir up his strength and courage against Egypt. Ptolemy will wage war with a large, very powerful army, but he will not be able to stand because of the plots devised against him. Ptolemy's advisors, Elias and Linnaeus, will try to destroy him. His army will be swept away, and many will fall in battle. Antiochus and Ptolemy, with their hearts bent on evil, will sit at the same table, lie to each other, but to no avail, because an end will be still come to the appointed time. Antiochus Epiphanes will return to Syria with great wealth, but his heart will be set against Judea. See the details? It's amazing. They figure there's 135 details that are fulfilled to the letter, because God knows what's going on, what's going to happen. Now I'm going to close off this last section here about Antiochus, because all this is again given to show how God knows what's going on, and he's in absolute control. But then there's going to rise someone to power who seems like he's out of control. He was stopped by the Western ships around Cyprus. That's the place of Shittim in verse 31. Let's see. At that time appointed, he shall return. Okay, verse 30. For the ships of Shittim shall come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the holy covenant. So shall he do. He shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the holy covenant. And arms shall stand up on his parts, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination that maketh desolate, and shall do as wickedly against the covenant, shall be corrupt for flatteries. But the people that do know the Lord their God shall be strong and do exploits. And they that understand among the people shall instruct many, yet they shall fall by the sword and by the flame, by captivity and by spoil many days. Now when they shall fall, they shall be holden with a little help, but many shall cleave to them with flatteries. And some of them of understanding shall fall to try them and to purge and to make them white even to the time of the end. Because it is yet for a time appointed. What happens is, he returns and he slaughters and persecutes the people. When he was defeated at Cyprus, or in Alexandria actually, by Rome, the general drew a ring around him and said to him, make your decision what you're going to do before you leave the circle, because if you don't turn back and leave, you're going to die. Okay, and he didn't like getting the ultimatum, so when he comes back, he is humiliated and he is angry. And he turns, as I said, his hostility towards the Jews. He rewarded those who supported the Hellenization of the company and abandoned the laws of the people of Israel. They were promoted. So Jews that were traitors to their faith were rewarded by him. Second of all, he forbid the continuation of the sacrifices and the observance of the festivals on pain of death. No more sacrifices, no more Jewish festivals. If you do, you will die. Three, he went and offered a sow on the altar of burnt offerings and erected a statue in the holy place to Zeus. And four, his army plundered Jerusalem, destroying its walls and its houses. This horrible act of desecrating the temple was called the Abomination of Desolation. It occurred under Antiochus, but it looks forward to the future Abomination of Desolation under the Antichrist that he says will happen in days to come. Matthew 24:15 says it's yet to be, and we see it alluded to in the book of 2 Thessalonians. So there's a future event that's very similar to this. Well, there was a major struggle after that arose between the Jews and Antiochus. Some of them revolted against this horrible treatment. And this persecution brought revival to the people of Israel. They started rallying and saying, wait a minute here, this is enough of this, and we need to stand up for our faith. Some Jews submitted to the flattery of the king, but others became very loyal to their faith. They get serious about it. Persecution does that. There was a purging of the Jewish faith, a separation of the true from the false. And he says the purging will occur until the very end. That's the whole purpose of persecution. That's the purpose of hardships. We're forced to decide, do I really believe this or do I not? And if I really believe it, I got to be willing to pay the price. I have to be willing to suffer for what I say I believe. That is the whole point of this section. We've had this whole book talk about the sovereignty of God over these pagan kingdoms. We've seen king after king rise to power, and yet God has kept his people true. And time again, he's delivered them and helped them. And he's given them visions about the fact that God knows the powers that are going to rise up. And now he gives them this prophecy. He says, yeah, and there's coming a hard time for Israel, a real purging of Israel, a real time of suffering. But those who remain faithful in the midst of this turmoil and remain devout to me, I will take note of them. And they'll be rewarded and they'll be blessed for it. And so this revival takes place, which is called the under the Maccabees, as they become very devout. And so by the time Jesus comes, there's been a purification in the sense of Israel. Even though you have some of these hypocritical people and hypocrites in power, you have that. But you have an element among the people that became very devout, very sincere. Idolatry was gone. And they were looking for the fulfillment of the promises. I believe as we get closer to the end, there's going to be a real purging during the tribulation period of the Jews. But I think there's a purging of the church that can take place during hard times. But we're forced to decide, do I really believe this or do I not? And we've always talked about the fact that during hard times is when the church gets purified. We've had it so easy in this country that we've gotten kind of careless in our spirituality. So let's get serious about it. God knows exactly what's going to happen. But just because he knows exactly what's going to happen doesn't mean he's going to keep us from hard times. Sometimes he puts his people through the hard times, but for the purpose of purifying them, to help them grow. That's why he turned to his disciples and says, tough days lay ahead. If you're going to follow me, you got to be willing to take your cross up and follow me. They're going to carry you off to places you don't want to go. They're going to persecute you. They're going to mistreat you. You'll have to bear your cross. And so when the hard times came to the apostles, they didn't say, whoa, what's happened? Is God out of control? Is someone, they said, no, God said this was going to come. And I want to prove worthy during the tough days. I want to be faithful when it's not easy. I want to be true to my faith. And so we don't live in fear, as I mentioned this morning. We live with the reality that God is in control. And whatever happens, happens for a reason. Well, I'm going to close off with prayer because I'm out of time. There's only a couple minutes left and we got to tear down. So let's just close off with prayer. Heavenly Father, I covered a lot, but that was the whole point. You knew in absolute detail the tough days that lay ahead for Israel. You knew that it was going to get worse before it ever got better. That there would come one who would make life very difficult for the Jews. But in the midst of that, you would bring good. You'd purify Israel. And Lord, by seeing how you fully knew what was going to happen, nothing happens outside of your control. We're thankful for that. We need to have a big God to know that we can trust you in the midst of the difficult times of life. May we realize whatever trial you allow to come our way, that you allow for a chance to glorify you and to honor your name. And we're faced with temptations, you said you'd always provide the way of escape, that we might bear up under it. You're with us, you never leave us, you never forsake us. May we entrust our lives to your care. May we recognize the fact that you are on the throne, always have been, always will be, and that the events of history are all moving towards an ultimate fulfillment. And we know what that is. Someday you're coming back to establish your kingdom upon this earth. And not even the gates of hell can stand against that. May we trust our lives to your hand. In Jesus' precious name I pray. Amen.